Alrighty, hello again everyone and welcome to it. Friday, we made it. It's the Daily Daily Caller Podcast for the 15th of February, 2019. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. Welcome and thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Please keep doing that. You're the only advertising we got. I love getting those emails saying, hey, I turned some people on to the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I hope you're going to have a great weekend. It's been a hell of a week. Coming up at the end of the show, the last 23 minutes of the program is our exclusive interview with Secretary Ben Carson, Secretary Dr. Dr. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. I love when people say, well, we have an exclusive interview. Isn't a non-exclusive interview a press conference? Of course, every sit-down interview is exclusive. It's not like ABC News is conducting an interview with the President of the United States, but CBS has their cameras and mic set up too. They're just not going to ask any questions. They're all exclusive interviews. Anyway, it's a great interview. You get to know a lot about the man and what he's doing over at HUD, and I use some of your questions that you guys sent me. So I appreciate that. As always, you can email the program, Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. And let me know your comments, complaints, whatever you got on the program. I always try to respond, although there's not always something to respond to. So I don't respond to everything. If you don't put a question in there, I don't read it. Or I mean, I don't respond. I might say thanks or something. Anyway, there is so much to get to that I can't do a rambling preamble as usual. At the end of this, before the Ben Carson interview, I will announce the winner of the signed Glenn Beck book, Control. The name has already been drawn. I know who it is. You're just going to have to wait. If you're listening to find out if you won, you got to wait. Although you probably could just fast forward. Anyway, lots of stuff. Let's see where to begin. The government will likely not be shut down. The president has decided that he will sign the spending bills that will keep the government open. Oh, don't you feel safer already knowing that bureaucrats will remain employed and paid through September? But of course, there's very little money in there for what caused this whole debacle in the first place, which is the desire and the need for a border security wall, any kind of barricade. $1.37 billion. Well, if we found that, you know, as a kid at the ice rink, I used to hang out under the bleachers and we'd play down there because you could swing around like there were monkey bars and everything. But every once in a while, you'd hear change fall out of somebody's pocket and hit the concrete. And ooh, man, we would scramble for that. We would be very excited if we found a quarter because you could buy a candy bar for a quarter or close to it. Or you could definitely play Miss Pac-Man, which was in the lobby of the ice rink. Well, that's about the amount of money that the president ended up getting, Republicans ended up getting, for a border wall relative to what is needed, relative to what he asked for, and definitely relative to what the government spends everywhere else. $4.4 trillion is what the government will spend this year, and we're going to spend $1.37 billion on securing our southern border. And Democrats are giddy as all get out that they won this fight. And make no mistake about it, they won this fight. If the Republicans had done nothing, there would be $1.6 billion for a border wall. So they did win something. Yes, we got more than $0 or $1, as Nancy Pelosi was offering at one point sarcastically, but they win overall. They had the resolve, and the Republicans did not. Like, Republicans get all squishy. Well, there's a government shutdown. We must. We can't keep the government shut down. Government employees are suffering. Yeah? Well, Americans are suffering. Who do you serve? Federal unions or the American people? But the president has announced his intention to declare a national emergency. So he's going to take the $1.37 billion and then he's going to declare a national emergency. And there are reports that he could move up to, this will allow him to move money around, to shift money around, that he could move up to $8 billion, which is more than the $5.7 billion that he wanted originally toward wall construction. That will immediately be challenged. The legal briefs, I know, are already written. You know they're already written. They're judge shopping now. They're out in California, ready to go the second the president puts ink to paper to declare a national emergency, or they're in Hawaii or in Oregon or somewhere, and some judge will go, well, we need an injunction against all of this, and then begins years of litigation. Get to that in a second, but I just want to give some context to this. This is from ABC News. ABC News has learned the president plans to announce on Friday his intention to spend about $8 billion on border wall with a mix of spending from Congress, congressional appropriations approved Thursday night, executive action, and emergency declaration. A senior White House official familiar with the plan told ABC News that $1.375 billion would come from the spending bill Congress passed Thursday. $600 million would come from the Treasury Department's drug forfeiture. $2.5 billion would come from the Pentagon's drug interdiction program. And through an emergency declaration, $3.5 billion from the Pentagon's military construction budget. I don't think a shovel will hit dirt or a backhoe will hit dirt before a judge says you can't do this and puts a stop to all of this and then begins a long legal battle. But this all really comes down to the National Emergencies Act of 1976. Congress has, for a long, long time, ceded power to the executive branch. The power of the purse, you hear liberals constantly talking about, the power of the purse belongs to Congress, and they're absolutely right. But for decades now, Congress has been ceding power to the executive branch, both directly and indirectly. The National Emergency Act is absolutely a ceding of power. It says, well, in cases of emergency, the president can declare an emergency and then has certain powers. Well, without getting into reading the legislation or anything, I just want to point out that it's not the only way that the congressional branch has ceded power to the executive branch. They write incredibly vague laws that empower the executive to determine how to implement them and what certain provisions mean. There's sentences such as a manner shall be determined by the secretary of this department or that department. That's Congress ceding power to the executive branch. So they can't really whine and say the president is abusing his power, he's overstepping his bounds, because they don't want to have their fingerprints on things. They don't want to have any responsibility when later on something goes wrong. They have been writing laws this way forever, quite frankly. So that a president might do this was about as predictable as the sun coming up in the east. There's a simple remedy for Congress, for anybody uncomfortable with this power, and personally I am a little bit too. I didn't like it when Barack Obama ruled through executive order, and I don't want a president who I liked to rule by executive order, because I don't like the idea of a president ruling through the power of a pen. Barack Obama's magic pen and phone. I didn't really care who wielded it. We are not a republic if a president can simply decide certain things. But in the emergency, the National Emergencies Act, Congress has empowered the president to do a whole hell of a lot. Looking through the history of the uses of the National Emergencies Act, most of them, the Brennan Center has a big long list of them, most of them are imposing sanctions or imposing restrictions on investment in certain areas. One was, you know, importing rough diamonds from Sierra Leone, things like that. It is something Congress could easily do. This would have made sense back in the 1800s, that Congress was in session for a few months out of the year. We actually had citizen legislators, novel idea. We had a part-time government. The president was essentially, the executive branch was the full-time branch, and the other branches, you had to have other work, especially in Congress. Well, that has changed. We now have a full-time Congress. They never go anywhere, even when you want them to. So now they're here. Now, this wasn't passed until the 70s, so it's not like this is a relic from old times that they're digging up. This was something that Congress gave to the president because they're lazy, because they like ceding power. Well, they like ceding responsibility to the executive branch. But they could repeal this. They should repeal this. If there is a situation, there is no situation that involves in the way that the National Emergencies Act has been used, just looking by what it has been used as so far. There is nothing that is an emergency that needs to be immediate. We must impose sanctions today because tomorrow will be too late. Lives are inbound. No, that's not how it works. Congress could easily act fairly quickly within a day or two, if not the same day, if they just use plain language and all agree that they're going to vote on this one thing and just move on it and impose sanctions against a country or individuals or whatever it is. This act is not necessary unless you're a member of Congress who simply doesn't want to have their fingerprints on sanctions or controversial issues. Maybe you want to play both sides against the middle, so you just want to pretend like the president did it. I didn't have anything to do with it. That's all this is good for, is political cover. There is no issue that can't be handled by existing law and executive power under the Constitution that needed to be addressed by this bill. So if you want to really stop the president or any president from declaring national emergencies to advance legislative priorities they can't otherwise get, repeal the National Emergencies Act. Right now would be a pretty good time to do it. There are a lot of Republicans who aren't happy with this, and every Democrat is unhappy with it because it's a Republican doing it. It would solve the problem for the future, but then they wouldn't be able to use this to their advantage in the future. Now, would they? While I disagree with, well, I'm of two minds of this, to be perfectly honest with you. I want this wall built, and whatever the law is, the president should take advantage of the law. Congress should change the law if they don't like the law. Whether or not this will stand up to constitutional muster really sadly depends on the disposition of the judges and the way that John Roberts has been going lately on the Supreme Court. Who the hell knows? But it shouldn't come to that. If Congress did its job, there would be no need for the National Emergencies Act, and this power wouldn't come into play. Of course, if Democrats in Congress actually cared about the national security of this country and the security of the American people and the safety of the American people, it wouldn't come to this either, but that's where we are these days. There is a school of thought on the right, which I described yesterday, and I'm going to go into it again because Nancy Pelosi kind of addressed it in this audio that we have. The idea is that if Trump declares a national emergency, he'll be setting a horrible precedent. A horrible, horrible precedent that some Democrat in the future, because there will be another Democratic president, that some Democrat in the future will then use to advance the liberal agenda, and suddenly conservatives who cheered Trump will then lament the Democrat doing the exact same thing. There's a difference. There is actual life at risk. There is a national security need. There's drugs and guns and violence coming across the southern border, not just illegal aliens. The Democrats don't care anything about that. But the idea that a Democratic president would go, I would love to declare a national emergency and start seizing guns I don't like, assault weapons, which doesn't mean anything, but that would be just an example that they would use. And I can declare a national emergency and start seizing weapons, or the climate change is a national emergency, and since Congress won't act, then I shall. The idea that a Democrat wouldn't do that because, well, nobody's ever done this before, I wouldn't want to be the first one, is ridiculous. Democrats have no qualms about doing absolutely anything they have to do to advance their agenda. How many times have you seen a resolution or a ballot initiative across the country in various states, perhaps in your state, where the Democrats lost? The people have spoken, and the Democrats lost. And what do the Democrats do? They immediately go to court and sue to try and overturn their loss. These are the people who chant, this is what democracy looks like. It's not what democracy looks like at all. It's what fascism looks like. They run to the courts. The biggest example, but there are hundreds of them, but it was Proposition 8 out in California, the gay marriage initiative, which passed overwhelmingly defining marriage between a man and a woman in the state of California. Liberals immediately sued. They thought they were going to win, and it turns out that they lost the black vote by quite a bit. And nobody ever talks about that. They all went after the CEO of Mozilla and ignored that the black community voted overwhelmingly in favor of that. Well, the Democratic Party didn't take that sitting down. They didn't go, yeah, well, the people have spoken. What are you going to do? They sued. They sued and won. And they still chant, this is what democracy looks like. The laws passed in Congress, the Defense of Marriage Act, was passed by Congress. It hadn't yet been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. And the Obama administration said, we're not going to defend this law. We're not going to enforce this law. We're going to pretend this law doesn't exist. Not that we're going to change this law. We're just going to ignore it, which is anti-democratic, un-American, that's for sure. If you don't like a law, change the law. You don't get to ignore the law unless, of course, you're a liberal Democrat, then who cares? This is what democracy looks like. A whole bunch of people ignoring the laws, apparently. So if you want to tell the president not to declare a state of emergency on the border, start building the wall or start the lawsuit about building the wall, the idea that a Democrat would then take advantage of this precedent is insane. A Democrat will do it anyway. Harry Reid used the nuclear option against the filibuster in the United States Senate, not because some Republican did it, but because he wanted to pack the courts with a bunch of liberals, and the rules of the Senate as they existed at the time wouldn't allow him to do that. So you know what he did? He just changed the rules. Democrats change the rules constantly. So from that perspective, I don't really have a lot of sympathy for that argument that Trump shouldn't do this because of the precedent it sets. I would like the president not to do this because of the principle it goes against. But that being said, I do want the wall built. So I'm on the fence on this one, which is a rarity for me. But let's go to Nancy Pelosi making this very threat in a press conference that she had yesterday up on Capitol Hill.
I know the Republicans have some unease about it, no matter what they say, because if the president can declare an emergency on something that he has created as an emergency, an illusion that he wants to convey, just think of what a president with different values can present to the American people.
Her voice is just so gross to me. It really sounds like she's chewing cud or something. But there she is. She's throwing the threat out there. No, no, we wouldn't do this unless Donald Trump did this. And then suddenly the floodgates would be open. Well, the floodgates weren't opened before by a Republican every time Democrats overstepped their bounds. Remember DACA, the Dreamers Act, the Deferred Action Against Childhood Arrivals, DACA. Democrats claim to care so deeply about those sweet, sweet dreamers. That was not congressional action. That was presidential magic pendulum. President Obama just decided it existed, took the law as it existed, and rewrote it. And Democrats cheered him for it. In fact, Democrats had, in the months leading up to his magic pen episode, had been encouraging him to do it. You remember the president had dozens of times before that said, I don't have the authority to just do this whole cloth. I need Congress to act. Then suddenly he decided, ah, screw it. I'll do it anyway. Because Congress refuses to act, I must. No, Congress actually refusing to act is Congress acting. It is a choice. Choosing not to vote is a choice. Choosing not to act is acting. Congress is under no obligation to give a president what they want. Barack Obama didn't care. He looked at it as Congress should pass this, but since they won't, I'll go ahead and declare it into existence anyway. Think of that what you will, but it is not democratic. It is not indicative of our republic. It is still worming its way through the court system today. But the Democrats weren't decrying that abuse of executive power when Barack Obama did it. Just the opposite. They cheered it. Now the media cheered it at the time. They're cheering it now, and they're all very concerned. What will happen to these dreamers? They're just the best. And you say, okay, we'll give you a deal for the dreamers. We'll allow the dreamers to stay. We get somebody was brought over here when they were five. Their crappy parents decided to break the law. They shouldn't be punished. But then the Democrats always have to take it further. Well, you can't deport their parents. So then suddenly you're rewarding lawbreaking. You damn well can deport their parents. You should deport their parents. They're the ones who consciously broke the law. And I don't like to see lawlessness rewarded. That's just me. I'm a heartless jackass. Speaking of somebody who's, I don't know if he's heartless, but he's definitely a jackass. Why this guy matters, I don't know. MSNBC dispatched Chris Hayes, Rachel Maddow with glasses, down to the southern border to talk to fading progressive star. Remember when Beto O'Rourke, just after the, oh my God, right after the election, right after he lost to Ted Cruz, there was this Beto mania going on. Oh, he could be president. He's thinking about running for president. He's such a hero. And the people on the left were in love with this guy. Now he's sort of irrelevant. He's faded. Still, MSNBC is paying attention to him. Chris Hayes goes down there and asks him a question. They're standing in El Paso, which is protected by a big wall. All throughout El Paso. It's kind of funny because Beto O'Rourke said the other day that walls kill. Walls kill people. Those mean walls. There's a roving gang of walls down in El Paso, Texas. Watch out for them. They will come up and stomp on you or whatever the hell walls do. They'll collapse on you. Chris Hayes asked a question from Congressman Dan Crenshaw, also of Texas. It's kind of funny. I want to play this only because of the way it ends. Chris Hayes says this is coming from Congressman Crenshaw, and then he makes a point of saying, he didn't text me. This is from Twitter. He didn't text me. He wanted to make sure that Beto and his audience knew that he wasn't secretly in contact with any Republican. Ew, gross. He didn't give his phone number to any Republican. He got this off Twitter. It's just kind of amusing before we get to his ridiculous answers. Here it is.
I want to pass along from a question from a congressman who does not represent the border, but he is in Texas, Dan Crenshaw, who's a new member of Congress. He's been very outspoken in favor of the president's agenda on the border, particularly.
Right.
And he wanted to ask you, he tweeted this, I'm just passing it along. It's not something he didn't text me.
He didn't text me. Don't. I'm not friendly with any Republicans. Don't worry. He didn't text me. I would smash my phone into a million pieces and throw it in the Rio Grande if a Republican ever texted me. Don't worry. I got this from Twitter. So here's the question and Beto's disturbing answer.
You know, would you take the wall down now? Here.
Yes.
Like you have a wall.
Absolutely.
Like, knock it down.
I'd take the wall down.
And do you think the city, if there's a referendum here in this city, that would pass?
I do.
I do. I totally do. I think that people just want, you know, anybody who feels like it, just for shits and giggles, to come walking across the southern border from Mexico into El Paso. What could possibly go wrong? He's so damn stupid. He's not the dumbest. I have a great audio drop for when we get to the dumbest person that I wish I could use twice in the show, but it'll lose comic effect. But he's so damn dumb. How do I mean? What do I mean? Well, he keeps talking.
Here's what we know. After the Secure Fence Act, we have built 600 miles of wall and fencing on a 2,000-mile border. What that has done is not in any demonstrable way made us safer. It's cost us tens of billions of dollars to build and to maintain, and it has pushed migrants and asylum seekers and refugees to the most inhospitable, the most hostile stretches of the U.S.-Mexico border, ensuring their suffering and death.
Ensuring their suffering and death. So you're saying walls work, Robbie O'Rourke? Yeah, it sounds to me like he's saying walls work. We've pushed them into the most inhospitable, all the worst places. Here's a thought, Robbie. If these people have legitimate claims of asylum, if they are really, truly, honestly seeking asylum, in El Paso, there is a border crossing. There are legal border crossings all throughout the southern border. If you have a legitimate claim for asylum, why would you walk through a poisonous snake-infested desert without water when you could march right up to the gate or go to the embassy in your country or stop in Mexico if you're fleeing from Central America and you're so afraid for your life? Why wouldn't you stop in Mexico? Because it's not about that crap, and we know it. They want to come to the United States, and this piece of crap wants them to come in the United States. This Napoleon Dynamite-voiced, gyrating moron. Well, how do I say that? What do I mean? Listen to him. He basically says, tear down the wall and let anybody from anywhere who wants to come in come marching across the border wherever they like. There should be no interference whatsoever for crossing the southern border. Yes, I'm not kidding. Robbie Beto O'Rourke is that stupid, but don't take my word for it. Take his.
More than 4,000 human beings, little kids, women, and children, have died. They're not in cages, they're not locked up, they're not separated, they're dead over the last 10 years as we have walled off their opportunity to legally petition for asylum, to cross in urban centers like El Paso, to be with family, to work jobs, to do what any human being should have a right to be able to do.
To do what any human being should have the right to be able to do. Enter the United States. We've put up these mean old walls. We put gates in those walls, you piece of crap. There's a reason people don't use them. They understand that their asylum claims are about as weak as your chin. And they don't want to have to go through the process. Oh, if they get caught, they'll definitely turn themselves in. But they don't want to wait their turn. Rules are for other people. What are you going to do? Plus, they've got to get all that heroin out of their butt before the balloon pops. They don't want to die that way. It is unfreaking believable how the mindset of the left works. He's basically saying, I don't care about Americans. I don't care what Americans want. I don't care about Americans being hurt. I don't care about any of that. I just want open borders. But he doesn't have the content of his underpants to come right out and say it, so he dances around it. And he dances like Napoleon Dynamite. All right, I got to move on because we're running out of time here, and I want to get in as much as possible. We're probably going to have an extra long show, which means I'm going to have to lower the quality of the audio a little bit so I can upload it. Sorry about that. You probably won't notice the difference, though. There was other news, a lot of other news yesterday, and it was amazing news. CBS News this Sunday has an interview with Andrew McCabe, former deputy director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And this caused a lot, the little clip that they released and Scott Pelley talking about it on the CBS Morning program has people buzzing about the wrong things for the most part. What Andrew McCabe describes, according to Scott Pelley, they were very safe about which audio clips, their video clips they released because they want you to watch 60 Minutes. They're talking about here on the CBS Morning show a coup attempt. A coup attempt in the United States of America, not in the 1850s, but in 2017. I'm not exaggerating. None of them seem to care. None of them seem to think it's a big controversy, that it's a big... They all are of the same mindset that Donald Trump is unfit for office. Therefore, if they tried to remove him from office through the 25th Amendment, that's... What are you going to do? That's smart politics. It's good for the good of the country. Anyway, all despots convince themselves that their tyranny is in the best interest of the country, at least at the beginning. Then it becomes about maintaining their power. Listen to this series of exchanges from CBS this morning yesterday.
It's certainly a very candid conversation. I've only read an excerpt from the book, but he's speaking very candidly about his feelings for the president and his impression of the president.
That's Gayle King, and she's talking about Andrew McCabe, and he's allowed to have his own opinions about the president and speaking very candidly about them. He's free to do that. The problem isn't that he's, you know, now written a book and giving his opinions about the president. It's that he was trying to impose his and his fellow travelers in the upper echelons of the intelligence community during the Obama administration. They're trying to impose their will on the people by trying to remove the president of the United States, by plotting to remove the president of the United States. You can dislike the president all you want, but if you're deputy director of the United States of America and you assemble a cabal of people inside government, inside the intelligence community, and decide actively to plot and scheme to remove the president, that's where it kind of becomes a coup. That doesn't seem to occur to Gayle King. She doesn't know. She's not particularly bright. If she weren't Oprah's friend, you would have never heard of her. And then there's Scott Pelley, who's genuinely incurious, who doesn't seem to have... There was a time, I'm going to go way long, but there was a time when you were embroiled in political scandal or whatever, something you had to address publicly as a public figure, that you would have to suffer through. It was part of a rite of passage. You had to suffer through a 60 Minutes interview or a Tim Russert grilling on Meet the Press. Not anymore. There's no safer venue for a liberal than 60 Minutes or Meet the Press now. Chuck Todd is just going to sit there and sniff the chair you were sitting in when you're done. He's not at all interested, if you are of the left, of challenging you in any way, shape, or form. And sadly, neither is 60 Minutes.
Was there anything in the interview that surprised you about what he was saying?
Gayle, the most illuminating and surprising thing in the interview to me were these 8 days in May, when all of these things were happening behind the scenes that the American people really didn't know about. There were meetings at the Justice Department in which it was discussed whether the vice president and a majority of the cabinet could be brought together to remove the president of the United States under the 25th Amendment.
They're talking about a coup. They're talking about people in positions of power and trust in the United States government, none of whom were elected, trying to find a way to plot to try and get a majority of the cabinet to declare the president unfit for office and remove him. And they're talking about it like they're going over the grocery list before they hit the grocery store. There is no, I couldn't believe it, and I confronted him about this, and who the hell are you as deputy director to decide that the president... Because one thing missing from all of this discussion is why Donald Trump was deemed unfit for office by these people, by this cabal of people, this junta of people. There's no discussion of that in this CBS clip. There's nobody saying, well, what grounds did they have other than he fired Director Comey? He fired Director Comey on the recommendation of Rod Rosenstein, by the way, who is part of this cabal. So, you know, figure that one out. There's no discussion about who do these people think they are trying to undermine our republic by deciding in secret and then plotting to find ways to remove the president of the United States. Nope, no discussion of that. Just straight up, yeah, well, that was very shocking that there were these people doing that. What are you going to do? Seems weird. Anyway, their hearts were in the right place. It's essentially what CBS News and 60 Minutes are saying.
These were the 8 days from Comey's firing to the point that Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel. And the highest levels of American law enforcement were trying to figure out what to do with the president.
I've read the Constitution, and nowhere in it, or anywhere in the law, as far as I've ever heard, is there a provision that says a whole bunch of unelected bureaucrats appointed to positions of authority by politicians can get together from time to time to decide whether or not they like the president, and if they don't, they can remove him. Nowhere in there does it say that. And it's just another day in the week that ends with Y to Scott Pelley. Well, it's amazing that these guys did it. You can almost hear a hint of disappointment that they weren't able to succeed at it in Pelley's voice.
I just want to put a finer point on that, because there has been reporting, but I don't believe there has been a source that went on the record to confirm that the 25th Amendment was discussed about removing the president. So McCabe is saying that that was discussed.
Absolutely. McCabe, Nora, as you point out, is the very first person involved in these meetings who has come out and spoken publicly.
That there was a discussion underway about removing the president of the United States.
Yep, just maybe we don't. I don't like this guy. They're all Hillary supporters. McCabe's wife had run for office in Virginia. She had gotten an obscene amount of money from Hillary and Bill's bag man, Terry McAuliffe. There is a lot of incest in politics, especially in Washington, D.C. Those ties matter. That tells you where McCabe is coming from. Hillary was his gal. It was his candidate. And he was ready, willing, and able, and excited about working for her. And then the people had their say and said, no, thank you. And so this guy decided to get people together and said, he could be a puppet of Russia. No evidence whatsoever of that. Nothing whatsoever. No proof. Nothing except wild speculation, fever dreams, and the contents of most Democrats' spank bank. That is the only place where there is any semblance of a shadow of proof that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia, with Vladimir Putin, that exists. But they live there. And so they impose that on everybody else. And these people getting together and talking about maybe we could go around the table in the cabinet and get enough people to get rid of this guy for the express purpose of not liking him. That's their reason for it. That is it. Oh, they'll say, well, we thought he might have been. There's good possibility because based on the Steele dossier, that garbage opposition research that they call a dossier to make it sound official. That is it. Oh, you know what? He had prostitutes pee in a bed that the Obamas slept in. Therefore, we need to remove him from office because he could be a national security threat. Maybe there's compromising evidence about him that Putin has. There's one thing about Donald Trump that anybody who believes this garbage should have realized is that he's not really concerned about anything embarrassing politically coming out. In the 80s and 90s, about 50% of the time, he was the one leaking to the tabloids embarrassing things about himself. He's not exactly somebody you could shame publicly. But the casualness with which CBS News correspondents and anchors and hosts discuss the idea of a coup against the President of the United States is astonishing to me. That there isn't a call for... By the way, Mr. McCabe has been under criminal investigation since his firing. I don't know how long it takes to determine whether or not somebody was fired or not, or somebody committed a crime or not. The Mueller probe moved much faster than this. But just as a reminder, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, so you know who they're talking about. Attorney General Jeff Sessions fired Andrew McCabe late Friday, hours before the former assistant director of the FBI was to retire. Sessions said in a statement that McCabe was let go for, quote, lacking candor under oath, end quote, in misleading investigators about the fact that he authorized conversations between FBI employees and the Wall Street Journal. Now, this wasn't something that was determined by the president. It wasn't determined by the attorney general. It was determined by the nonpartisan inspector general of the Justice Department that Andrew McCabe had lied to investigators, which, as we all know now, is the main crime that people have been charged with by Mueller. That's about it, really. Americans, anyway. Lying to federal investigators. If there was no investigation, there would be no crime. But they created an investigation and then they created crime. McCabe, according to the inspector general, was guilty of the exact same thing. And he was recommended to be fired over that by the inspector general. Jeff Sessions did fire him over that. And that's kind of glossed over here in this discussion, that this guy was fired by the Trump administration for lying, is under active criminal investigation for lying. It's been over a year. I don't know how long it takes to figure out if somebody lied and whether or not you're going to charge them for that. It seems that justice isn't all that swift when it's going after a liberal, but I think that gives it some important context here.
They were counting noses. They were not asking cabinet members whether they would vote for or against removing the president, but they were speculating this person would be with us, that person would not be, and they were counting noses in that effort.
And this was not perceived to be a joke.
This was not perceived to be a joke.
No, just journalism is a joke. They're actively talking about an attempted coup in the United States of America, as if it's no big shake, no big deal. Eh, what are you going to do? Just another day in the office. They all privately think, then the world would have been a better place had they succeeded. Speaking of the world being a better place, had they succeeded, this is kind of funny. Amazon, remember they were going to open up headquarters two. They're opening up two headquarters two, one in Northern Virginia and one on Long Island in New York. And the liberals were very upset that the tax incentives that Amazon was getting in Long Island were outrageous. And how dare they? And some on the right were, too. I'm not a big fan of tax subsidies. If nobody offers Amazon tax subsidies, Amazon's got to go somewhere, don't they? But municipalities want the jobs, the 25 to 40,000 jobs that would have accompanied this. So they say, hey, we'll sweeten the pot if you come do it here, because while you might not tax the company all that much, you might give the company a tax break, you make up for it tenfold in the economic stimulation that comes along with 25 to 40,000 jobs that my 18-month-old daughter or 19-month-old daughter, whatever it is, she would understand that concept, but progressives don't. So after complaints, after lobbying, after threats from local politicians, after riling up the citizenry and everything else and throwing all kinds of roadblocks and promising more the entire time, Amazon yesterday said, to hell with it. We're not going to build in New York City anymore. We're not going to build on Long Island. We're not going to bring those jobs to the New York area. We're not going to bring those jobs to New York State. You don't want 25 to 40,000 jobs? Fine. You don't have to have them. All that economic activity, the tens of billions of dollars in economic boom that would come from this is leaving. And progressives celebrated this. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez celebrated this. The New York Times celebrated this. I want to read this couple of sentences from the New York Times and play some audio from Alex Cortez, because she's incredibly, they're all incredibly, insanely, economically illiterate. This is from the editorial board. This is the official position of the New York Times, talking about the governor and the mayor who were in favor of this. And Mrs. Cuomo and de Blasio should have better prepared for what was in store, since their constituents are maybe more worried about housing, subways, and the cost of living than in job creation alone. Yes, what would 25 to 40,000 new jobs and billions of dollars in economic activity, what could possibly that impact that have on housing, subways, and the cost of living? Might it make it easier to deal with those things? Yes, the subway system in New York City is a disaster. Now, it's not been repaired for 20 years. The left has been ignoring it. They've been pissing away money on health care for illegal aliens and housing for illegal aliens. So their priorities are elsewhere. There was an opportunity to collect the estimates, or the low-end estimates, for what tax revenue would have gone to New York as a result of this Amazon deal was around $23 billion. $23 billion over 10 years. You could, I would assume, do a lot of track repair and a lot of subway repair with that kind of money. Not to mention the jobs that would come along with that, good paying jobs that would make the cost of living a little bit more bearable, make people able to afford more housing. But again, that's just me. I understand common sense economic principles. Leftists do not. But that the New York Times said people are more interested and more concerned in these things than jobs. Jobs lead to those things being better, you morons. But the New York Times editorial board was not actually the biggest moron involved in this situation. That, my friends, is reserved for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whose name you legally have to say like that, or it's a hate crime.
I think it's incredible. I mean, it shows that everyday Americans still have the power to organize and fight for their communities, and they can have more say in this country than the richest man in the world.
That is the member of Congress for the adjacent area to where these headquarters would have been. Her constituents would have benefited immeasurably from these jobs that she is celebrating the death of. She was confronted, and not really confronted, that means that they actually asked her difficult questions. She was asked gushy sort of softball questions by ABC News in the halls of Congress. And she's very excited. I think it's great. The people stood up against jobs. Of course, this is the woman who authored the Green New Deal that promises a guaranteed economic security to people unwilling to work. So what's 25,000 to 40,000 jobs amongst a couple of friends? Now, in fairness, they did vote for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and one would assume that Amazon would want basic skills in the people they employ, like the ability to tie a shoelace, so the people who would vote for her may not qualify, although some possibly could, or maybe they could cheat by wearing Velcro shoes. But she wasn't done being stupid.
What do you say to those that criticize them pulling out that, you know, the district now is going to lose 25,000 jobs that could have come there?
Well, one of those things is, A, we were subsidizing those jobs. So for the city was paying for those jobs. So frankly, if we were willing to give Amazon willing to give away $3 billion for this deal, we could invest those $3 billion in our district ourselves if we wanted to. We could hire out more teachers. We can fix our subways. We can put a lot of people to work for that money if we wanted to.
This is perhaps the dumbest thing she said thus far. There is not a Brinks truck driving around Lower Manhattan waiting to dump $3 billion on the doorstep of Amazon the second they broke ground. These were tax breaks. Money was not going to be collected from Amazon. So if now, actually, because this deal is not going through, there isn't a truck with $3 billion with nothing to do with it, and they can just go and dig into it and start building all these wonderful things. That was actually going to happen with the $23 billion of tax revenue they were going to get should this have happened. But she seems to think that the state of New York was sitting there with a fresh check that says $3 billion to Jeff Bezos, and now they can spend that money elsewhere. She's that dumb. She is that economically illiterate. And therefore, it allows me to introduce perhaps the greatest drop of all time that I think and frankly fear we're going to have to use all too often, especially when dealing with her.
This could very well be the stupidest person on the face of the earth.
It's funny because it's true, and it's sad for the very same reason. Yeah, congratulations, New York. You elected an economic illiterate. And congratulations, media. You elevated an economic illiterate. And congratulations, Democrats. You are now so afraid of this economic illiterate and her social media footprint that you are willing to follow her as she pushes 25,000 jobs into the Hudson River. God, these morons. But don't worry, if you're unwilling to work, she's going to take care of you. You'll get an extra slice of government cheese. That is about all the time we have. We've got the Ben Carson interview coming up. I think it's a good one. So stick around for that. Just a quick update on Jesse Smollett. There are reports the actor from Empire, who was allegedly accosted by the fans of Donald Trump when it was minus 20 degrees outside. They just happened to be milling around in the freezing cold with a bottle of bleach and a rope to tie around his neck. That story has fallen apart completely. He now says that he never said that it was anything to do with Donald Trump. And now police are talking to two men who are apparently Nigerian, one of whom at least appeared as an extra on the show Empire. And there's a possibility that he was doing this for publicity, or I personally think it was more likely that it was a drug deal gone bad. Somebody decided to beat him up. Maybe they knew who he was. Maybe they didn't. I don't know. But it is certainly not the hate crime, and especially the Trump-inspired hate crime, that the media got itself into a tizzy about. And immediately, because Make America Great Again was associated with it in the original lie reports. Kamala Harris and Cory Booker both tweeted about this as being a lynching. I wonder if they'll ever correct the record. Being a Democrat means never having to say you're sorry. And finally, drumroll, which I don't have a drumroll sound effect for, and I don't feel like getting one for this. The winner, the name drawn from the pile, and there was a ton of entries, and I feel really bad because we got a ton of entries, and I only had one thing to give away. So in the future, I'll try and give away more. Of the signed Glenn Beck book, Control, is a woman named Carol Fortune of North Carolina. Congratulations, Carol. Thanks to everybody else for entering. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. You can email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. Up next, 23 minutes with Dr. Ben Carson. You're not going to want to miss it. Have a great weekend.
This could very well be the stupidest person on the face of the earth.
All right, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Caller podcast. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host, and as we always do, we bring somebody into our world who's far more successful and interesting than we are, except this time we thrust ourselves into somebody else's world. Joining me today is Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Dr. Ben Carson. Mr. Secretary, thank you for coming on. Thank you for agreeing to this.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
I don't know what you would have gotten had you won the bet, but I appreciate you coming on here. Before we get into policy and accomplishments, I want to talk about biography a little bit about you. You and I have very similar stories in that we were both born in Detroit and then moved to Baltimore later in life. We wildly diverged after that. You went on to become successful, and I'm sitting here. But talk about your upbringing and how your upbringing helped prepare you for a public life.
Well, you know, there were a lot of things that I think prepared me along the way. First of all, you know, when my parents got divorced, I was 8 years old. That was incredibly devastating. But, you know, my mother only had a third grade education, so we had to move, had to find some place to go. We didn't have any place to go. We ended up being taken in by some relatives in Boston. And it wasn't a particularly pleasant environment. It was multifamily, ghetto, rats, roaches, violence, gangs. Both of my older cousins were killed, that kind of environment. And then adjacent to a public housing complex where my cousins lived, we frequently went there after school. I was a terrible student, really didn't think that I could accomplish. And my mother was working extraordinarily hard.
But when you were a terrible student, did you know you could do better and refused as a sort of rebellion, or did you think that was the best you could do?
No, I just didn't think that I could do any better, so I really didn't try very hard. And, you know, after a couple of years, we moved back to Detroit, still in a pretty awful neighborhood. But at least my mother was independent at that time. And I was still a terrible student, but it was really her making us read books. She was a spy. She said that she was a domestic, and she'd go from one house to the next house cleaning. But she was really spying on those people, and she wanted to know what made them so successful. And she concluded that it was because they did a lot of reading, a lot of studying and planning. So she came home and imposed that upon us. And,
but she couldn't read herself.
She couldn't read herself, no.
And what was it like when you found out your mother couldn't read after your mother making sure that you read? You thought, well, because she would quiz you on the books.
Yes.
She had no idea whether or not you were telling the truth.
Well, she was very smart. She could pull the wool over anybody's eyes.
That's a sign of a good parent. You got to do half of that.
Absolutely. But I was actually even more impressed with her when I found out that she couldn't read and that she was trying. And she started going to school, going to night school. And interestingly enough, she got her GED the same year I graduated from high school.
it's a great story. And then, of course, you went on to become a world-famous neurosurgeon, separating conjoined twins at the head, first time ever. Everybody knows your biography there. I want to ask you a little bit about the National Prayer Breakfast speech that you gave, because it just happened again.
Right.
It was sort of your political coming out party. You were famous before that.
Right.
There had been a movie made of your life. Your accomplishments were known, but not as widely known as that speech that you gave, critical of Obamacare, in front of the President of the United States. When you gave that speech, you were reaching the end of your medical career.
Right.
Were you planning on making a move to politics, or did the reaction to that say, hey, wait a second, maybe I could do this?
No, actually, I was very surprised when I got the invitation to speak, because I had spoken at the National Prayer Breakfast in 1997 when President Clinton was in office. And I wasn't aware that anyone ever did it twice. But some investigation showed that one person had done it twice, and that was Billy Graham. And I said, wow, that's a pretty good
company.
And but I didn't know what I was going to say until the morning of the prayer breakfast, which caused some anxiety on behalf of the organizers. But I said, I'm sorry, I don't know what I'm going to say. But it was crystal clear to me at that point. And I said it, and it resonated so much with...
Did you expect it to? Did you think it could?
I didn't think it was going to be a life-changing event.
Right.
But after that speech, every place I went, you know, there were people with placards, run, Ben, run. I had over 500,000 petitions in my office. And I finally said, you know, this is ridiculous. I don't want to run for president. And I prayed, and I said, Lord, you know, people run for president, they have a Rolodex with a lot of connections and a lot of money, and they have an organization. I said, I don't have any of that stuff. So I said, if you really want me to run, then provide all that stuff. Boom, overnight, I had all that stuff. We were bringing in more money than the RNC every month. It was ridiculous.
Well, it blew up, but you were up at in Baltimore, which is a very liberal town. The reaction, as excited as some people were for the prospect of you running, there were a lot of people who were angry at you for, in their minds, existing wrong.
Right.
You were uninvited from speaking at the commencement of the Johns Hopkins Medical School.
Right.
Talk a little bit about the dichotomy between the two, and I think that's sort of an indication. We've really gotten even further apart since then.
Well, you know, there is a strange culture in our country where if you become known as a conservative, then everything that you do is done for a nefarious purpose. And you never would do anything because it's the right thing to do. That's how a lot of people on the left feel. And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time worrying about them. I just spend a lot of time thinking about what is the right thing to do. So I recognize fully that, you know, running for president, subsequently taking on the job of Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, that would take a lot of people and create enemies of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're not my enemy, but I become their enemy,
right?
Because of who you associate with. And you just recognize that that's a peril, and you ask yourself, is it worth it? And I started thinking about it, and I said, which is the direction that our country is going in, and what are the implications for our future, and what's going to happen to our children and our grandchildren? It was really when the grandchildren came along that my wife got on board. She said, we can't just let this go on and let them have to suffer the consequences. So, you know, I think it is a very worthwhile thing. And I think about the sacrifices that many of the people who founded our country went through. You take somebody like John Hancock, a very successful businessman who was willing to give up everything. Benjamin Franklin, willing to take money out of his own pocket to pay for the Boston Tea Party because he didn't want the wrath of the English. I mean, it's amazing what people sacrificed and were willing to go through.
I want to ask you, we're going to switch into your current position, but I love asking this question of people who have made major transitions in your life. Before you became Secretary of Health, of Housing and Urban Development, I imagine you thought you knew what the job would be like, or you had some sort of general idea. What's the biggest difference between what you thought it would be like and what it's actually like?
Probably the biggest difference is how much interaction you have to have with other parts of the government to get things done. If you could do everything on your own, you could do things very efficiently and very fast. But, this group has to check it off, and then this group has to check it off, and then you have to come back and redo this, and it takes forever to get things done.
If a hospital ran this the way government does,
everybody would die.
That's what I was trying to get, because you're on the president's Affordable Housing Council, correct? Which you would think would be run out of here, but is it run out of the Treasury Department?
Well, actually, the Affordable Housing Council is still in the process of being put together. The Opportunity and Revitalization Council is the one that is being run out of here.
It's such a gigantic thing. How are you finding handling it? Because, you're working, as a neurosurgeon, you work alone. You have a couple of people that hand you things that do exactly, because life's on the line. Here, you can't do anything alone.
No, you can't. And, it's interesting because when I took this position, a lot of critics were saying, he doesn't know anything about this or this or this, and how can you possibly run an agency like that? And it actually demonstrates their ignorance, because the secretary of an agency is more like the CEO of a medical center. CEO of a medical center has to coordinate, plan, and strategize for lots of different divisions, cardiac surgery, infectious disease, anesthesia. Doesn't mean he's an anesthesiologist or an infectious disease specialist or a surgeon, but has to be able to coordinate all of that to make it work effectively.
How have you found moving the bureaucracy in the direction that you and the president want this department to go? Is it Sisyphus? Is it pushing a rock up a hill? Is it? Do you describe the process, because people have gone up against bureaucracies as a customer.
Right.
Never actually tried to change one from the inside.
Is it easy? No, it is definitely not easy. But I have been so blessed to have just terrific people here with me. I have, without question, the best people of any agency in Washington, D.C.
And you're just saying that because some are in the room.
No, it has nothing to do with that. And it really has made it a whole lot easier. When we sit down and we strategize, we plan what needs to be done, how it needs to be done, we get the collective buy-in of people who've been here for decades, along with people who just are good people with very good ideals and know how to execute. And it's working. But I would be amiss if I told you that it was easy. The bureaucracies don't like to change.
No, they do not. And you came into a difficult position in the midst of still a very long recovery of the housing market. We had a bubble in 2008. People out there lost a lot of money, a lot of homes underwater, some of whom have not recovered yet, as well as new people entering the hopeful home buying market. I'm in the hopeful home buying market myself. What is the role of government, and what can government do to help sort of make housing affordable? Because a place like San Francisco, there's a massive homeless problem.
Mm-hmm.
Public housing would help those people, but a square foot of land costs more than the GDP of some countries.
Right. Well, government has to be smart. They have to be analytical, and they have to learn how to use data appropriately. 10, 15 years ago, when everybody was saying everybody should be in a home, and they started messing around with credit scores and all kinds of things, and you put a lot of people into homes that they couldn't afford.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of that, today, in some communities like the African-American community, you have fewer homeowners than you had then. So when the government does things in a manner that is not analytical, it can sometimes be quite detrimental. So what we have to do is ask ourselves, what is the barrier that keeps us from being able to build affordable housing. And what you'll find is that there are these horrific zoning restrictions and other regulatory barriers, environmental things, that add so much cost to the production of a unit that it makes it unaffordable for a large portion of the population. So what we really need to concentrate on is how do we remove those barriers, and how do we re-educate people? And, you know, some of it comes from NIMBYism, not in my backyard. Mm. And I understand NIMBYism very well. People say, you know, my biggest investment is my home. I don't want some gigantic public housing thing built next to me. Well, what they don't realize, of course, is that we don't do that anymore. The government used to come in with a big bucket of money and build these things and then walk away while it immediately started deteriorating. That's not done anymore. Now it's much smaller. It's built in a way that's consistent with the architecture of the neighborhood. It's built in an appropriate place in the neighborhood, not in the middle of the block of single-family homes. And it makes it possible for policemen and firemen and teachers and nurses to live in the same communities in which they work and not drive 30 miles away.
And that's getting more and more difficult. A listener, Lisa, said that she would ask you, what is the role of HUD and how to in getting young people the means necessary to afford their first home?
Mm-hmm.
I think HUD flies under the radar with a lot of people. They don't know what it does.
Well, we're very concerned about the young people, and that's one of the reasons that we've been working hard on the condominium rule so that it will make it possible, because that's a first step for many people in the home ownership realm. And we will have that done pretty soon, that first step. It makes a big difference. But again, the whole affordability issue and looking at innovative ways to provide housing, accessory dwelling units, converting garages, shared homes, 3D printed houses.
Really?
Yes. Manufactured housing. This is an area we used to just think about trailers. Manufactured housing has just zoomed in terms of technology. And a lot of manufactured houses now look better than site-built houses, and they withstand natural disasters better. They're about 30% less expensive. So these are all things that are being worked on right now, which will make it much easier for people to get into the home ownership realm.
One of the things that makes it harder to own a home, this is a listener, Karen, so a tough question for you. She's wondering about how we can possibly uplift the value of the nuclear family and head of household fathers in society. A nuclear family, an intact family, has a much easier time getting a home and getting out of public housing.
Mm-hmm.
I know that that's something that's near and dear to your heart.
Right. Well, you know, there was a Brookings Institute study, a large study on poverty, and they concluded that there were three things that a person could do that would reduce their likelihood of living in poverty to 2% or less. Number one, finish high school. Number two, get married. Number three, wait until you're married to have children. There are some valuable principles there. And, you know, in our housing policies for decades, we've had some perverse incentives. For instance, if you make more money, you immediately have to report that so that your rent can be jacked up. If you bring another income-producing person into the environment, your rent goes up. If you get married, you probably lose your subsidy altogether.
Did you find that the policies that were in place when you came in were sort of designed to perpetuate people's dependence on government rather than, you know, a leg up?
Well, you know, I hoped that that wasn't the reason it was done, but that was certainly the effect. But we're in the process of disentangling all that right now.
Drew wants to know, what's the difference between urban development and gentrification? One, everybody wants one and everybody condemns the other.
Right. Well, gentrification, of course, means you're moving out, you know, people who are economically disadvantaged, and you're bringing in people who are advantaged, and therefore changing the character of the place. What we want to do instead is create mixed-income neighborhoods, holistic neighborhoods that have all the appropriate support mechanisms within them, so that people who want to live in the cities can live in the cities. People who want to live in the suburbs can live in the suburbs. The assistance that we provide in terms of rent, we want that to be something that's acceptable everywhere. We've started recently a national survey of landlords to see what keeps them from wanting to accept vouchers. And we found some very interesting things, like in one area, the city guaranteed all the landlords that if the voucher recipients damaged their property, that the city would repair it. The resistance to vouchers went from there to there, just like that. And it was interesting because most of the people with vouchers are not going to tear your property up.
No,
in fact, they're interested in making sure that they're good tenants so that they don't lose it.
Right. It's a weird thing. It's one story presented as the norm. It's always the worst case scenario presented as the norm. Yeah. Chris has an interesting question outside of the realm of HUD. He said, if you'd comment on the press comments regarding the supposed chaos in the White House and a little bit about President Trump's management style. His other secretaries, cabinet levels, there's been a lot of turnover. You're still here. You seem to be getting along well with the president. Are these reports overblown? Is there some truth to it? Is there autonomy, or is the president involved in what's going on?
There's not as much chaos as people would have you believe. Certainly not generated through the White House. But there is turmoil. You know, I know a number of secretaries who, you know, like myself, have been accused of things. And when that happens, you know, they have to hire counsel. These counsels are like $800, $900, $1,000 an hour.
Yeah.
And not everybody can
afford
that.
It's just an accusation. That's all it is. You just accuse somebody of something.
Right.
And suddenly you have to defend yourself.
And, you know, once the bills get so high, you say, you know what? I think I'll go back into private life. And that's happened to a number of people. It's totally unfair. Totally unreasonable, but you know that's why it's called public service and sacrifice. I hope at some point we become a little more mature.
You think we've weaponized sort of the grievance and the process there, because anybody can file make an accusation.
We have, and I personally am very concerned about the implications of that for the future of our country, because I want good people to go into government. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to say, "Is it really worth it? Am I going to be savage? Is my family going to be disadvantaged?" You know, that shouldn't be the case.
You have a great relationship with the president, though, working relationship?
I do. We have a very strong relationship.
You happy with the job? You going to stick around for a while?
I will certainly be here through this term.
Through this term. Now, through this first term, when you look back on it 2 years from now, what do you think will be your greatest accomplishment? Has it happened already, or are you on the cusp of it? What are you going to be most proud of?
It's in the process of happening. One of the things that we did is we brought in a CFO. For 8.5 years, there had been no CFO here. There were not appropriate financial controls in place.
Lost money.
A lot. Can you imagine the billions of dollars that flow through here with no CFO? So putting those things in place has changed.
Is it corruption or incompetence?
Both. There were a lot of corruption on the outside, mm-hmm. because there weren't financial controls, and so money could, you know, be fungible here and there. That was not good.
Well, hopefully you can get this house in order and our housing in order. Dr. Ben Carson, Secretary Carson, more impressive titles than I'll ever have. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for talking to us.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.